Hello and welcome back to the Rope Access and Climbing Podcast. I'm your host, Mikey Stevenson, and today I'm interviewing Max from GeoArc. Today we're talking about what it's like to rig into a live volcano. If this is your first time here, please make sure to subscribe and follow us wherever you get your podcasts. So stay tuned. Step into your harness and get ready for a podcast about the vertical world. All right. Well, thank you very much, everyone, for tuning into today's episode. I'm joined here with Max from GeoArc. And for the people that are unaware who you are, let's dive into some introductions.
That's great. Thanks, Mikey. My name is Max Dugal. I was born and raised in Quebec. Moved to Ontario about 14 years ago. Doesn't feel like it. Feels like I've only just moved in, but it's been a while. My background is come from recreational rock climbing, about 15 years of it. About 10 years ago, I took my first rope access course, and I've never left. I transitioned into full-time rope access career, and I'm now a co-owner of GeoArc.
Excellent, excellent. So today we'll be chatting about your company, GeoArc. Here we'll be kind of diving into an expedition that you did in Central America and some of the things that have led to the success of that trip or that expedition. So to start off today, I just want to kind of ask, how did you start your company, or where did it kind of get founded?
I think, first of all, it's important to mention that GeoArc has been a team effort since day one. I do have great partners, business partners with me. I think we complete each other. So it's not just a single man effort. It was definitely a team effort. I know it probably sounds a little cliche, but our goals have been to start and grow a business that operates differently than others. And we're trying to find meaningful projects. The goal of the GeoArc Foundation, which is what we're going to talk about today, the foundation, is to link with partners that are seeking access support to acquire scientific data predominantly.
Awesome. Where did the thought of going into the mouth of a volcano and dropping stuff into it come from? Like, this is just absurd. Like, you know, you're going into the mouth of a volcano.
Pretty crazy, isn't it? That's a question that's come up quite a few times. And it sounds like an absolutely crazy idea when you first hear about it. But when you're well prepared, well surrounded, it's fully achievable. Basically, one of our founders had been studying this volcano for close to a decade. And by linking with us, he was now given access to a whole different aspect of rigging that he never had access to in the past. Let's keep in mind that this volcano did not always have a lava lake. The lava lake came up, I believe, 4 years ago. So for him, it was perfect timing to get different data that he wasn't able to get in the past.
Excellent. So talking about this project, this expedition, from start to finish, how long was this project?
I want to say that start to finish, it was about 12 months. The actual expedition was about 3 weeks, but it was definitely, as you can tell, a lot of planning prior to. Mm-hmm. I've had numerous conversations with industry experts, put forward my rigging plans to Petzl, which was one of our sponsors. And after months of planning, getting the gear together, because that was another thing, making a gear list that was sensible. Then we, put boots on the ground. We arrived in Nicaragua, I believe it was early July, if not even July 1st. We were then at the crater for about 3 weeks to perform a few different scientific experimentations.
Excellent. While you were there, what was some of your biggest challenges?
It's kind of hard to narrow it down to one biggest challenge. Yeah, I mean, we're dealing with the weather, rain, which was then turned into acid rain because of the volcano plume, the plume being the gas that's being emitted. Okay. So that was one of the challenges, the weather itself. People management is always a challenge too. With something as attractive as a volcano, everybody kind of wants to be a little selfish and kind of step in and get their own moment of fame. Mm-hmm. But luckily, we had a great team, and this did not really turn into an issue. But I wanted to say that the day-to-day, just keeping people in line and knowing what each person's task is, was probably the biggest challenge. I mean, just to put it in perspective, to send two or three people on a very simple task across the crater was potentially a half-day mission. So you don't want to send people to a place that they shouldn't be, or waste people's time. We were on a pretty tight timeline. We knew that we were flying in and out within the 3-week period.
Right. Let's just chat about some of the stats of this project. Obviously, this is not like, you know, a standard job that you would do for rope access. It's a little bit larger scale. So kind of give some perspective on the listeners and the viewers here of how much rope did you have to travel there with?
So first thing, we did not want to ship anything. Just the state of the country, we wanted to make sure that everything that we need was actually going to make it to the expedition. So we had to cut back on some personal clothing and personal items so we can fit more of those ropes and carabiners and whatnot.
Instead of, you know, three pairs of underwear, you only got away with one?
That's correct. Or you get some once you get there. You learn to get creative. So between four of us, only four of us were leaving from Toronto. So we got the gear shipped to our apartments. And each of us had two very overweight luggages, checked luggages, which we basically paid a lot of money for. And our carry-ons were probably a good 60, if not 80 pounds each. They never really weighed our carry-ons, but they were heavy as can be. So trying to keep a straight face and not make it look like you're carrying bricks.
Yeah.
But in terms of ropes, I want to say that between the four of us, we probably have about 3 kilometers of ropes in large duffel bags. And the rest was carabiners, slings, anchors, because we had to drill anchors as well. So we weren't traveling light.
So this is not something you're just going to go backpacking through Europe with, eh?
Not really. Or if you do, you're going to get real strong.
What was the largest opening on the in the mouth of the volcano? What would be the largest span that you had to, you know, combat?
Largest span, I believe, was 800 meters, or roughly about 2,400 feet or 2,500 feet. It's fairly circular, so fairly circular. Mm-hmm. And so pretty consistent, 800 meters across.
Wow, that's impressive.
Yeah, and I mean, quite frankly, when we got there, first thoughts in my head when I looked at the span was, oh my God, what have we done? Why did we fly in so many people? This is going to be unachievable. It was way too large.
Yeah. How did you get your final number? Like, how did you find out that, okay, this span is X number of meters? Because, you know, you probably ended up having to cut up ropes or whatever, and just like, that would really suck to cut the rope, you know, 200 meters short. Like, you'd be screwed. So
that would be the end of an expedition.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
So basically, Guillermo, who was the head volcanologist on the project, like I said, he's been studying this volcano for close to a decade. So all the stats, all the data, he already had. We also cross-referenced with Google Earth to make sure, and mm-hmm. we brought a little bit of extra. So at the end, our full rigging included about 2 kilometers of rope, so just over two, but we brought a little bit more just in case. Most of that equipment you cannot source in Nicaragua. The closest place would have been to get it from Costa Rica.
Okay, gotcha. Now, from the ropes to the lava, yes, I said lava, everybody. I know this is not just a make-believe thing in a rope access assessment. This is actual, real lava. What was the distance? You know, obviously you have deflection of the ropes and the system and whatever, but what did that kind of look like?
So from what we called our master point, which was, I mean, called it horizontal, but there was deflection. So from the master point down to the lava lake, we were looking at about 400 meters or 1,200 feet.
Wow. And you had to send equipment down there to get information for the scientists, so they could execute whatever tests that they're looking for and stuff like that. So that was something that you had to repetitively do. So you had some sort of quantifiable information that was about the span you're working with.
That's right. And for all your listeners that are familiar with ropes and rope lengths and what kind of orders you can make, everything that we received was 200 meters. So if our span side to side is 800 meters, we had to deal with passing knots through haul systems and whatnot. We had to use large shift pulleys so that the knots can pass through as well, up and down for our vertical profile. So there was definitely a lot of learning curves and logistics involved.
Now, for those people out there that, want to tie knots together, what was the knot of choice for you when joining two ropes together? Because now you're dealing with an actual object that needs to fit over top of it. I'm assuming probably something along the lines of like a Kootenai pulley.
Yeah, that's right. So we did have a couple of Kootenai pulleys in the system. I still have one right here. I'm looking at it. It's looking pretty sad. So the knots, if I remember correctly, we just went with barrels.
Okay.
We wanted zero possibility of the knots coming undone. And we weren't planning on untying those barrels at the end anyways.
Okay.
So keep it simple, keep it strong. That's kind of was the mentality.
Awesome. What is the elevation above sea level of the volcano?
The rim of the crater is at 635 meters above sea level. So it's definitely not considered altitude or high altitude. It's fairly low. It's about 20 kilometers away from the nearest city of Masaya. So it's a fairly easy volcano to get to acquire good data.
All right. Next question here is how many people were on your team and kind of, if you can, given a little bit of an idea where they came from.
As I said earlier in this interview, team is definitely what made this expedition successful. We definitely would not have pulled it off without the team that we had. We had a team of 22 people, half of which were flying in from different countries. We had people from Spain, England, Canada, and we had the other half of the team was local based. So Nicaraguans, most of them from the area where this volcano is located as well.
Awesome. So you got some good buy-in from the local people as well to be there to do this expedition.
Yeah, most definitely. We were more than welcome, arms open. And definitely my hat goes to the locals who helped us out in many ways. We were able to find local welding shops for fixing some tripods and whatnot. We were able to find accommodation. Some restaurants donated lunches every day. So without the local support, this would have been very, very difficult.
That's awesome. And in one way, you kind of put them on the map a little bit, just kind of, show people that this volcano is open and is there. So, but ultimately, at the end of the day, what drove you there is probably the negative effects on the climate and the negative effects on the people that live there because of the volcano.
Their health, general infrastructure, anything that's downwind from this volcano, there's a bit of a cone of influence, and everything and everybody is affected to some degree, right down to the ocean.
Wow. That's incredible. So, did you lose any gear in the volcano at all by chance? Or was this a once in a lifetime, nothing went wrong kind of situation?
Come on, Mikey. We're rope technicians. We don't drop anything. We never lose anything, do we?
Exactly. Everything's tied off, right?
Exactly. To answer your question, I think I'd like to call it donations to the volcano gods more than anything.
Okay, fair enough. You're donating equipment. Okay, yeah, I like it. I like it. Can we donate gear to the ground? Is that what we're gonna refer to when we drop things?
That's
We
right,
drop things.
exactly. That's right. It's no longer a discrepancy, it's a donation. So yeah, we did lose some gear, but quite frankly, nothing substantial. So we lost a couple GoPros that basically went a little too close. We lost a piece of steel cable.
What do you, I'm sorry to interrupt you. What do you mean too close? Too close to what?
To heat. to the lava. Oh. So as we were lowering down different types of sensors and thermocouples, we also had GoPros going down so we can see basically what does this look like from a closer look. And because really all we had is binoculars from the distance, and you can see really well inside the volcano with just naked eyes, but we kind of wanted to get a closer look. And when things got a little hot and potentially got to some nylon, which doesn't do well with heat, and had GoPros attached to it, the whole thing turned into a donation. when I say the whole thing, I want to say that's maybe about 5% of our rigging. The rest was intact. We were able to reuse the exact same system day on end. But we probably lost about 100 feet of rope, I want to say, a couple carabiners, and that's about it. And that's stuff that went into the volcano. The rest of the gear is still considered to be, it's here, but it's not usable.
Yeah, interesting, interesting. What else did you kind of lose? You were just saying some steel slings and...
So a piece of steel cable, which if you can get a visual, we were trying to capture a sample of lava with a locally made kind of like steel bucket. And that bucket was attached to a steel cable to dissipate the heat. It was about 100 feet, I want to say. Yeah. And then to that we had, we're going to call it a fuse, which was a high temp resistant piece of rope, then attached to a piece of regular rope. Okay. So if you go at the fuse of high temp rope and down, that's what we lost.
Okay, so you're saying that the lava melted or took, or you donated the bucket to the lava lake? Is that what I'm getting from this? You didn't retrieve your bucket of lava?
Funny enough, and not funny, is that we actually did get a lava sample, but we got greedy and decided to dip again and try to get a second one. And that's when the volcano said, nope, that's mine.
All right. So for the people out there, if you didn't know already, lava is very hot.
It sure is. Great. You know, when you play the game, the floor is lava. There's a reason for it.
Yeah, fair enough. Now, we've chatted about this a couple times before, and, you know, I've also, you know, watched your presentation on this twice now. But, you know, you talk about the volcano having had a heartbeat. Do you mind explaining what you meant by the volcano having a heartbeat, and what does that look like? Because I, you know, excluding our conversations, I would not even know what you're talking about. So
you can call it a heartbeat. You can call it like a breathing almost. And so basically it's kind of hard to tell if you haven't witnessed a lava lake. By the way, there's less than 10 active lava lakes in the world at the moment. Don't quote me on that. Those are the last numbers that I got. So there's not a lot of opportunities to see it. If you're looking at it, it's churning and the lava is bubbling or moving. There's also gas being emitted. So you can kind of see that the whole thing is living. It's really not until we had our rigging in place. So picture the Mercedes sign of ropes dangling above a volcano. And all you could see is a pulse. The ropes are going up, they're going down, and we're talking hundreds of feet of deflection, but you can kind of tell that the volcano is breathing out, the ropes are going up, all of a sudden it's breathing back in, the ropes are coming back down. So it was a different visual confirmation that this thing is breathing and living.
Wow. Okay, interesting. Absolutely. Now, excluding just watching that, you had a lot of like load cells there. Did you find different readings on the load cells when this deflection breathing or heartbeat thing was happening?
Yeah, definitely. And I guess this was one of your previous questions about challenges, but one of the challenges that we had is gear limitation. Mm-hmm. Having 2 kilometers of rope in the system, having heavier loads going down almost 1,200 feet, we weren't really sure what kind of readings we'd be getting on, let's say, the IDs or the anchors themselves. So we received some load cells from Rock Exotica, and we basically put a load cell at each leg of our system. So okay. You could tell it was fluctuating. Normal readings, I want to say that in just a system moving up and down or breathing, we were probably in the 1 kN, so nothing really significant.
Yeah.
And going up and down, it would probably go up by 0.5 kN or so.
Okay, that's not so bad. But you did note it was enough of a change that you could tell on your end with the load cells.
Exactly. And when we did touch the lava, when we got our first sample, we knew that we had touched because all the load cells went up to about 3 or 3.5 kilonewtons all at the same time. So we knew that something had hit the bucket.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Interesting. Then you just had to be a little greedy.
That's right. Well, it was probably a good half-day process to get the bucket in place. So you start at the crater, and then you go horizontally. You pass a few knots along the way, and mm-hmm. it's a team effort between 3 tripods. 2 tripods are pulling when 1 is paying out. So communication was absolutely crucial. But after 4 hours of getting the bucket in place, and we thought we had dipped it, we didn't want to pull it all the way back, finish our day, and have nothing.
Yeah.
Hindsight 2020, right?
Exactly.
Do you still have any of the gear from the trip, and is any of the gear usable?
I still have pretty much all the equipment that we brought back. Mm-hmm. So none of it, everything has been quarantined. Okay. None of it has been used since. We still have 6 IDs, all the rope, maybe about 2 kilometers of ropes, carabiners, rope grab, pulleys, and we still have our master point, which is Rock Exotica UFO, and it's currently hanging in our office. And I think it's going to be wall decoration for forever onward.
Right.
So none of it, like I said, is being used. I could easily say that all the textiles would pass a visual inspection by any competent inspector. Mm-hmm. The hardware, so all the metals, they look like they've been dug up from an old ruined site. So they look like they're from early 1900s by now. The steel components are very, very corroded. And even the aluminum components have corroded, and they've got some severe pitting. So based on that, that tells us that the textiles probably have been affected as well. I think it's just a matter of time or making time to go and pull test that equipment and get true results.
Yeah, that would be very interesting to see the kind of the results that you got on a pull test of rope, and just kind of give you an idea.
You can do that a second podcast with you.
Yeah, there you go. That would be so cool. Now, you did mention that you came from varied backgrounds before you got into rope access, and you know, obviously rope access fed into that. How did cross certifications help you with this expedition?
I wouldn't go as far as saying that I've got cross certifications. Mm-hmm. I think I was lucky enough to be exposed to very diverse types of environments. So my actual background, I studied adventure tourism to be a nature guide. So during this certification, I basically got exposed to tent rigging, tarp rigging, which is pretty simple, but that's kind of where it starts with haul systems and locating good anchor points. Mm-hmm. Then got into swift water rescue. So exposed to my first real haul system with back then they called the Z haul or the Z haul. Which is just basically a basic 3-to-1. I've also got just over 15 years of rock climbing experience. So again, different environments, learning to rig some top ropes or pick different anchor points and different angles. And finally, I think it's mostly the last 10 years as a rope access technician working for different companies. I've been exposed to very diverse types of jobs. indoors, outdoors, simple rigging, complex rigging. So I think it's once you put all of these experiences together that you end up basically being with a team that, that can do advanced rigging. And to that note, my cross certification, quote unquote, everybody on my team was in a very similar boat. So all of the, we had a rigging team and each person was basically handpicked because they had different skills. So that, that was very, very important with us. We didn't want to go to that expedition with 10 people that are all good at the same thing. So we all had, we all were very well-versed, but also in very different ways.
Absolutely. Now, expanding on that a little bit, you were talking about your team there and your rigging team and different certifications that they had or experiences that they had. Now, in a lot of cases, rope access technicians kind of think that, or the the thought process is that, you know, they, you throw them in a position and they'll be able to, you know, make it work. But you're in mountainous terrain. You're not in an industrial or commercial setting at all. So how important was selecting people with experience in mountainous terrain over and above just rope access technicians for you in this selection process?
It was very, very, very important. And some of the local, so our team of riggers was composed of both expats, which was us, and some local people that did have a good mountainous terrain experience. Mm-hmm. Whether it's just being familiar with that volcano or just extensive hiking. So they'd be very good at moving gear around. And a few of the people that we've trained on the spot in terms of how to use the equipment so that we don't have to be right there. It was very, very critical to select our people for all tasks, really. I mean, we had people driving food back and forth for us. We had people driving around to do air sampling in different towns to see the concentration of the acid in the gas. So it definitely was one of the most important things to do for us was to select varied skills within our people.
Absolutely. Awesome. Well, thank you very much. That's all I have for today. Is there anything else you'd like to add to this?
I'd like to say some thank yous. We had 22 people on the team. So thank you to all of those people. I'm not going to name them all because that'll be another 10 minutes to your podcast. So the team was crucial. I can't say it enough. Big, big thank you to Petzl, who was our primary sponsor. They've donated funds and equipment for this project to happen. You can see a video of our project, I believe, on their foundation, Petzl Foundation website, as well as on our just on YouTube if you Google GeoArc. Big thank you to Rock Exotica as well for providing us very good deals on some of the equipment, including the load cells. Thank you to personal family as well, that was very supportive. And thank you, Mikey, for the interview and making allowing me to tell the story again.
No, thank you very much. You know, I'm kind of touched by this story every time that I hear it, so it's pretty awesome. It's not every day that you get to talk to someone or, you know, learn about volcanoes. Thank you very much for taking the time to be part of this episode and telling your story.
It was my pleasure.
If people have any questions or would like to get in contact with you, what's the best way to reach you?
Yeah, I'd be happy to answer any of the other questions or have a conversation with anyone. So I'm pretty easy to find, whether it's Facebook or Instagram. Just my name is what you're going to see. Feel free to reach me at via email, max@geoarc.org. So that's GEOARC.org. And I look forward to talking to you again and answering any other questions.
Awesome. Well, thank you again, and I'll chat with you later.
Will do. Thanks a lot. Have a good one.
All right, well, thank you very much, everyone, for tuning into today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please make sure to like this, follow us wherever you get your podcast, subscribe if you're watching this on YouTube. Let me know in the comments what you thought about this and, you know, kind of different, you know, situations, weird situations that, you know, you've been involved with. So until next time.